We've got one of probably my favorite guests back in. Absolutely awesome mind. Lynn Alden, by the way, is that person. And I can tell you that when it came to, as I mentioned prior to the event, when it came to bringing his entire board on board in terms of his plans for the Treasury, Michael Saylor took this lady's piece of research. I'm very happy to be on her mailing list, and I've also gone for the premium mailing list just to get access to one of the most fastidious researchers, very earnest, very graceful, very humble, despite towering over all of us in terms of a deep, deep dives and detail on this incredible financial system with us. I'm looking forward to bringing her back right into the room. And I'm going to go straight to audio and check if we have Lynn. Lynn, how are you? Can you hear me okay?
Yes, can you hear me?
Oh, fabulous. Most certainly can. Do we have a camera share as well, Lynn, that you can afford us?
We should. I keep hitting camera to go on and it doesn't go on.
Ah.
Within the software.
Give it a second. Maybe hit it once. There's sometimes a bit of a delay and we'll let it sit for a while. Let's crack straight on anyway, and we'll give it a little bit of a moment to do. We're being slightly frivolous as well, and we're burying 2020, a super tough year for many. But also there were a couple of things that were of great value, and we can talk a bit about the negatives. Beautiful. There you are. We see you. And is it Italy in the background?
Probably.
It looks like Tuscany. It looks absolutely lovely. Great to have you back. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on. You're a real favorite.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, sure.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. We're delighted. By the way, a bit of frivolity as well first, being the Christmas spirit. You've been made the leader of the great revolution. I'm not sure if you're going to be able to see that. Am I sharing screen? Sorry, we're doing something so complex here. It's mind-boggling. Let me try and make sure I've done it all right. Here we go. We're running GoToMeeting within that. You are the Princess Leia of the Rebel Alliance against the dark forces of the economic realm that are looming, along with fellow friends George Gammon, a.k.a. Luke Skywalker, and Brent Johnson joining us later. Speaking to, I think it's a bit rich to have me as Obi-Wan Kenobi. I wasn't sure if there was a dark Sith or something else a little bit more intimidating. But anyway, super glad to have you back. I suppose let's start. First of all, let me just say something that I think everyone should do before I hand over and bring you in. Guys, this is Lynn's website. And can I just say, you understand what people think of her research, given my opening gambit there. Go to lynnalden.com. You will go to the investing letter. I think her premium, correct me, Lynn, I don't think it was very much for premium for the value that you offer. Give us the details if you can.
So the premium research is $199 per year. Yeah, so I keep it at a pretty low price point.
Yeah, I know I paid something with a one. I just wasn't exactly sure. It's absolutely worth it. You get access to the thoughts of someone who is truly, truly on her game. You've become in a bit of a rising star, Lynn. You've got immense fans in our YouTube following. People are really excited to have you back on. I would say while it was a tricky year for 2020, your star's in great emergence. Congratulations for all that you've achieved and the fame.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, this has just been a challenging year for a lot of people, but you know, it's one of those things where it opens up opportunities as well. And so we all make the best of it. So I'm glad to be putting this year to rest though. You know, it's been a really interesting year. It's been a really busy year. But I think, you know, I'm hoping that for a lot of people, 2021 is better.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it has been hard. For your opening gambit, one of the, I suppose, the first questions that we're asking all the guests that are coming on, what really came out for you in 2020 that was biggest, I suppose, new learning or maybe an enforcement of something that you already understood, but it suddenly became more apparently clear that you're going to then maybe treat consolidate into your already immense research and say, okay, going into 2021, that's what I learned, and this is how we're adjusting for the year ahead?
I think the biggest enforcement is, always recognizing that things can go a lot farther than you think. And so when you think something is overextended, there's a good chance it can double from there. And some examples of that, and that can go both sides, that go up or down. So for example, like if you thought oil was cheap, let alone seeing a negative oil print, or for example, if you thought, Tesla was expensive, right? in the middle of the year, see what it did later in the year. I think that's the biggest takeaway is that, whenever there's a trend, you have to be very careful not to be on the wrong side of it, just because it can roll over you if you think, okay, it has to stop here. The reasonable thing is to stop here. But then, things always, often go a lot further than they would based purely on reason.
I love that. It's almost like the Jimi Hendrix realization, max distortion. It can go even further on the upside and on the downside. And in a sense, it is a market of great distortions, wouldn't you say, Lindsay, in terms of almost perverse?
Absolutely. I mean, this is, it's the biggest economic shock in modern history combined with the biggest fiscal and monetary response in modern history. You're basically getting a lot of noise in the system. And one of the stocks that I pointed out a couple of days ago was kind of representing a lot of this is Disney stock, right? Because Disney, if you look at their earnings, they're vertically down. If you look at their stock price, it's vertically up. If you look at their physical properties, they're crushed. If you look at their virtual properties, they're taking off. They're laying off tons of employees, like 30,000 employees. And so that stock kind of encapsulates 2020. More than most other stocks can. It kind of puts all up in one, big example.
You mentioned something positive on the virtual side for them. Is it enough to countervail the fact that their fun fairs and entertainment places are going down, or is it just hyper overvaluation?
Well, so in terms of earnings, it does not cover it because Disney Plus, despite being wildly successful, in terms of gathering users far faster than they originally thought, it's not yet profitable. Similar to Netflix, really. So if you look at earnings, for this year and likely, what analysts are looking at for next year, earnings are way down. Yeah. Now, but because the stock market assigns a higher valuation to recurring, software streaming, service type businesses, they're valuing that virtual side of Disney much higher than they, are basically discounting some of their physical stuff. And so I don't think it's particularly attractive at this time. I was more bullish on Disney back in 2018, 2019. I wrote about it a couple times. But with this year, I no longer view it as attractive. Now, that's with the caveat that, going back to our previous point, that doesn't mean it can't go up, another 50% from here for all we know. So you need some sort of reversal for, any sort of action to take place on the downside. But fundamentally, it is hard to say, buy it here. And I think, fundamentally, it's strong. I think it's one of those things where instead, we have to see how the dust settles. Maybe the stock price will come down. Maybe the earnings in the years ahead will come back up. And maybe at that point, Disney will be a better buying opportunity. But here, it doesn't look very good.
Aren't we at risk? Almost, it's become, the one world trade. We, people talk about, there was the emergence of SAB with Anheuser-Busch, and it was almost like one world beer order. The SAB used to have all the emerging beers, and all the big brands were in the American company. In a sense, we've almost coming down to it's the proliferation and devaluation of currency trade, that it's almost not a shorting market. Outside of debt, possibly, which I have very, very concerns, grave concerns, but in the scope of equity, gold, silver, Bitcoin, I pitched this. Is it the net long? It's the buyer's trade with certain caveats regarding volatility, obviously moderate leverage, if any at all. But are we at that stage that so many of the markets can overshoot? And most of the trends that are in the distortion that you've been describing, in other words, the hypervaluation within Disney, which is their virtual game, those are the things that are most likely are following the Tesla model to hyperextend as well.
Yeah, so I think, we have been this year, of course, in a buyer's game. And I think there's a couple things to watch. So a lot of that has been correlated inversely with the dollar. And so as the dollar's weakened, as we've had a ton of liquidity, we've seen a surge in risk assets, in reflation assets. And so I think, you know, that because we've come pretty far pretty fast, you know, I think, you know, there's a decent chance for corrections and more volatility in the months ahead. But, you know, I think as we look out a couple years, I think that's where, you know, the market starts to kind of sift through some of these things. And I think there's still a good amount of bullishness left for especially some of the cyclical things, you know, things that, you know, if you look back at the past 5 years, they didn't do very well, even if they might have done well in the past several months. Whereas I think some of the things that really took off for the past 5 years, and that, you know, by most metrics are very, very expensive, I think some of those are, you know, vulnerable to a downtrend. And we've already seen kind of early signs of growth to value rotation. Now, there has been a bunch of those kind of fake outs in the past. And so we have to keep monitoring this one to see if it's real this time or if it's another fake out. But one thing that kind of adds this one some degree of credibility is that it's occurring with a very big shift in monetary and fiscal policy, which tends to be where those growth to value rotations occur. So the probability for this one being a more sustained reversal is higher. But again, you have to keep confirming it just because there's always a possibility it just rolls back over again, and keeps, you know, resulting in growth overvaluation.
There's been a small element recently, and that's quite near term, of the Russell and maybe the medium caps doing a little bit better as well than even the FANG mega techs recently, although they've hyper performed over the longer term. Is that also possibly a little bit of a sign of a bit of rotational adjustment? The relative valuations got a bit too stretched apart.
Yeah, that's mostly what I'm referring to. I mean, if you look back, if you look at the Nasdaq, for example, it had a blow-off top in late August, and then it corrected, consolidated, and then we've seen differences in the name. So, right, you know, for example, Tesla took off, some of the others lagged, but you know, basically, ever since that pivot point, the tech stocks have on average been a little bit weaker. Meanwhile, you know, with some of the vaccine announcements and, you know, with some of these other news during that autumn period, we've seen a resurgence in some value stocks, in small stocks, in mid-cap stocks, in foreign stocks. And so that's basically the growth to value rotation I'm referring to. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to see you know, somewhat of a tick back in that because some of these, you know, banks or energy names have come pretty far pretty fast. But I think, you know, looking out over the next 3 to 5 years, there is some pretty good opportunity in some of those more cyclical entities compared to, you know, all the capital that piled into Apple and Tesla and other stocks this year. You know, if we start to get, say, slightly rising inflation expectations or slightly higher bond yields, you know, some of the justifications that people use when they poured into those stocks at any price, right? Which is basically that, you know, in a world without growth, they wanted to pour into companies that were growing, you know, regardless of the valuation. But if that reverses it off, that sentiment shifts, and you know, basically those oceans of capital start looking in other directions that are relative pawns in comparison. So the commodities market, even Bitcoin, as well as it did this year, is still a pawn compared to some of the, you know, the global
Absolutely.
bond and stock markets. And so I still think that, you know, if that rotation does continue after, you know, perhaps a pause, you know, that's one of those things, just like how tech stocks went a lot further over the past 5 years than many people thought, including myself, if I would have, you know, given a guess 2 to 3 years ago, you know, where some of these stocks would be. I think, you know, once if that rotation gets underway, some of those commodities, some of those other sorts of trades can then move a lot further than some people think. So a lot of people kind of look and say, you know, just because it's near term overbought, maybe it's over, maybe the rotation's finished. And sure, it could take a pause, but if that rotation's more structural, that's one of those things that could persist for years.
I would just comment technically, it does look like it still could go a little further, though, the Nasdaq. I wouldn't be trying to call tops on it. Which is your favorite? Is Tesla your favorite most overvalued, if we can call a fluffiness a stock?
Yeah, I think Tesla's fundamentally the most vulnerable. But yes, I agree. You know, you don't want to stand in front of a freight train, right?
No.
So anyone trying to short it or anything like that needs a very clear cover point, needs a very clear kind of technical signal. So it's
Yeah.
not just something you say, it's fundamentally overvalued, therefore I want to short it.
Yeah.
So no, it's more like fundamentally overvalued, and then you sit there and wait and wait and wait until you see some sort of reversal. And so we got a partial reversal, like I said, back in August, but they have managed to recover. And then we've seen a performance gap between, say, Tesla doing pretty well and Amazon doing weaker. And of course, Tesla's big catalyst at that point was inclusion into the S&P 500, which is now largely finished. And so it'd be interesting to see now that all that required buying is done, what's going to happen next week.
Yes, you would almost think it's almost vulnerable now, particularly more than ever. And in some sense, I'll just take some of those drawings off because it broke out of what we call the continuation. We trade technically, and we know it's fundamentally not well managed. But because we shoot and scoot, hit and run traders with clear stop losses, we did actually commit the cardinal sin of holding our nose and buying, Lynn, and it paid. But we are also very fundamentally aware that it is a parallel universe in some senses, and that's why we shoot and scoot and we take our good gains and we run. But it's just such a it's almost an incredible story that's I'm finding a little bit difficult to believe. But I think sometimes you just got to follow the money. That was the continuation we were in on. I just bring that size down a little bit. Sorry, I think you know it. And that was probably roundabout. It was very fortuitous because the announcement of the inclusion in the index came when we were just about inching up there, and that's run at virtually the 700. And I would imagine it probably just run that technical level as well. If we say these tech stocks are the great underblown, what do you like right now at an equity level? Where you is there any value anywhere? And if there is, is it only relatively valuable compared to how ridiculous everything else is, or is there some real, by even Ben, Graham standards, value out there? What do you like?
So if you asked me that this summer, I would say that there is pretty good deep value out there. And an example would have been some of the energy names. But since we've had somewhat of a bounce in some of these commodity names, some of these value cyclical stocks, we've kind of come off of those deeper oversold levels. But I still think, if you look around the world and at certain sectors, there are stocks that are trading for absolutely normal valuations, right? So there are some, for example, healthcare stocks that are trading at the same valuations they've traded at for many years, and that by most standards, are totally normal. Same thing if you look at, for example, I looked at some, Japanese trading companies or Japanese industrials. A lot of those are trading at, pretty low valuations. Despite the fact that their fundamentals are doing pretty well, and the Japanese market's actually been doing quite well since 2012. And so if you look at certain global banks, for example, not many investors want to touch banks, but they're historically trading pretty well. A lot of them are able to get fee income to offset the fact that their net interest margins are tighter. And I still think that, even in the energy sector, we have had this rally. But I still think, looking at several years, some of these energy transporters, some of these low cost, strong balance sheet energy producers are reasonably well positioned.
Yeah, great. I like that response. That's the Japanese Nikkei, which seems to have had a great rebound from the March lows, from about 16,000 to 26,000. So that's pretty decent. One thing I noticed in terms of how you're talking is that you're definitely, you're not American centric at all, and you're talking a lot about the foreign markets. Because my finding is the overall, the U.S. in the markets as a whole are extremely fully valued. I'm just wondering, what's your favorite geographies? And maybe even a comment for our UK friends. We were live streaming this at the same time, so on the YouTube channel, so it's great. I'm keeping half an eye for some questions, and I might pipe some of them in. But if I take the FTSE 100, I'm sure you're probably familiar, but the UK stock market has been pretty abysmal. It's probably dominated by financials, we might be able to say. But we're at about 6533. Let me pull that through a little bit. It's slightly disappointing amount of history that I've got there. I'll look for a better one. But actually, I moved to the UK when Tony Blair was in charge in 1999, and he was bragging about the stock markets, and it was just shy of the 7,000 level. And he said he was bragging about, we had all-time highs. Politicians claiming credit for stock market movements, as they are wont to do. And to this day, whoops, that's the FTSE short. Sorry, I'm messing around a bit here. To this day, it still hasn't recouped the 6, 8, 6, 9,000 that it was on. I've got a bit of a short history chart here while I'm scrambling to find a good one, but we're at 6533. So that's the better parts of 21 years and essentially flat, even slightly down.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at, Europe as a whole has been in like a 2-decade bear market. Japan has been in a 3-decade bear market. And of course, with Japan, they bottomed in 2012, so they've been in a more of a decent bull trend. For the UK in particular, I do think that, the market is reasonably attractive at this point. So, their index is kind of dominated by some of these more value plays, right? So you have Unilever, you have healthcare companies, banks. For UK banks, I'm kind of, torn on. They have alcohol companies, they have tobacco companies, they have commodity companies, energy. And so, a lot of that's not the stuff that did very well this year.
No.
But if you do get that more kind of a cyclical rotation, and you have kind of a several years of value outperformance, I do think that the UK market is one to look at, especially as it gets past this year and some of the political headlines. And so, looking out around the world, I mean, I think, earlier this year, I was pretty bullish on Chinese tech stocks. They did pretty well. Now I'm more interested in some of these other emerging markets. I think Latin America has some value. I like Southeast Asia. India's some of my Indian stocks. I focused on one of the Indian banks in particular. That one got a little bit stretched, but I still think it looks good for with a several year view. I think Russia's pretty attractive. That's one of the cheapest markets. Of course, they're mainly commodities and some banks and things like that. So they're of course very value tilted, very unloved market. And so I'm overall looking for kind of a period where international stocks outperform U.S. stocks. And of course we have to keep confirming that. It's never just kind of set on a strategy and just kind of sticking to it at all costs. But
Yeah.
as long as certain things maintain in place, as long as certain monetary policies, certain fiscal policies, certain things with the dollar, certain things with, the virus, whatever the case may be, as long as certain things start to play out, I do think there's a pretty good chance of continued international outperformance.
And when you're talking about the international outperformance, are you taking into account the dollar devaluation that we've had? In other words, in a real term, in some form of a woku currency, or are you talking in nominal terms?
So I think if we just take them all in dollar terms,
Right.
then I think that they are, can outperform U.S. equities.
Yeah.
And it's one thing about the dollar, again, is it's one of those things where one of the concerns right now is that it's somewhat of a crowded trade to be short the dollar. Dollar bearish was unpopular earlier this year and now it's pretty popular. Again, if you look at say the weekly chart, it's not even oversold, the dollar index. And so if we look back over the past 50 years, there have been three really big dollar cycles, right? So we had the big dollar spike in the mid 80s, then we had the second dollar spike in the late 90s, early 2000s, and
Yeah.
ever since late 2014, we've been in the third strong dollar environment. And that particular strong dollar environment was triggered by the end of quantitative easing. So as soon as the Fed stopped quantitative easing in mid 2014, the dollar just shot up compared to other currencies because on a relative basis, the US had tight monetary policy, which is
Yeah.
of course a joke because we had zero rates and we just basically because we were not actively debasing currency, we were now one of the tight ones. And so we entered a strong dollar environment. Then in 2017, we had kind of a fake out, right? Because the dollar weakened, we had a global boom in international equities. But then the Fed at the beginning of 2018 began quantitative tightening. And they're also, of course, raising interest rates. And so we again had a relatively tight US monetary policy. And so that stopped the dollar decline, put it back on a bullish trend that lasted into mid 2019. But then due to the repo spike in late 2019, the Fed was forced to end quantitative tightening, go back to basically quantitative easing. Then of course we had the pandemic, we had a brief dollar spike. The Fed accelerated quantitative easing. And ever since then, we've been on a pretty bearish trend for the dollar. And so my base case is that we're probably ending this overall third dollar spike, which could bring us to pretty low levels on the dollar. And so that can, it can be oversold in the near term, right? So I do think that bounces are warranted whenever you get oversold, whenever you get too many people on one side of a trade. But I do think this is one of those things where kind of like how tech stocks kept, over they kept outperforming over the past 5 years, despite the fact that there were always concerns that it's too crowded, that too many people are bullish on them, that the valuations are too high. I do think that over the next, you know, call it 3 years or more, you could have a similar situation with the dollar where people keep saying it's oversold, it's got to bounce, it's got to do this, and there will be bounces. But I do think that that thing can potentially power pretty low over a 3 to 5 year period, as long as it keeps, you know, breaking certain support levels and the technicals keep, you know, kind of being in its favor.
And in fairness to you, you had reverted quite bearish on the dollar around about this period as well. So you've been very accurate on that. A good call and well played. There's a technical low in and around the 88 that I guess that you're expecting to see fall with further dollar devaluation. And if I just bring a little bit more of the chart on, I'm hoping you can see okay. We had the huge spurt up that you referred to with the relative tightening or less debasement situation on the July, August 14-ish. So how far do we go? Do we return to the 80? Is it a round tripper from the breakout? Because this was for us a bit of a technical breakout when that occurred, and that was pretty single-minded. And actually, it does illustrate your point as well. People would have called tops on dollar strength all the way through this period, and you actually would have traded right up at one point at nearly 104, which could indeed mean there's still plenty more to come. Where do you see? I mean, it's a looking glass question, I suppose, but how far do you think it could go?
So I am watching that 88 level pretty closely, and it's also, I mean, that we also could just isolate the euro to dollar chart, because that's the biggest component of the dollar index, and that has, you know, that has a similar support level around that same point, something like, you know, $125 to the euro, and so I think that's a key, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to see kind of a, you know, resistance or support there, depending on which, you know, axis you're looking at, you know, dollar euro or dollar index 88. And so that'd be kind of a prime area to have some sort of bounce or some sort of, you know, kind of bouncing off that support level. But if we do break that, I think, you know, in the years ahead, we can see, you know, dollar index at 80 or below to kind of, you know, close out this dollar bull period. Now, of course, there are certain things. If the Fed comes out, you know, the next meeting 6 weeks from now and says, hey, we're going to start tapering bond purchases and we're going to, you know, then you reevaluate that. So that's just, you know, as long as the Fed maintains that rather aggressive quantitative easing and very large deficits. And of course, you know, compared to Europe and Japan and some of these other markets, you know, currencies that make up that dollar index, most of those have current account surpluses. Yeah. And that tends to be supportive for a currency. And so, you know, when all central banks around the world are actively, you know, supplying liquidity and debasing their currency, the United States currency has a tendency to fall harder because, you know, we have this structural current account deficit.
Yeah.
And so that's generally why we see the dollar have these big shifts. But that's always dependent on the fact that the Fed is easing. So, you know, if we see signs that they stop or slow down, we have to reevaluate that dollar bear thesis.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, technically, this was an interesting base during the euro crises. This was Draghi's do whatever it take at 140. And for the technicians, it's kind of a little bit of a W bottom that if we retrace up to the 125, you might then actually have a similar target arguable that could even take out the pre-Draghi, I think it was called the bazooka statement where he said he'd do all it takes. So that could be a really powerful move. How do we play that? Honest comments, just before you answer that, sorry. I got the impression that there was a very precarious situation for the emerging FX currencies taking place. So particularly on the lira, it was getting most disorderly in its down. It's a big country, it's a big population. No matter what anybody says, it's the gateway to Asia and Europe. And this recent devaluation has taken some of the heat out of the highly indebted, in dollar terms, emerging market nations. So is it not almost, if forgive me for thinking at a macro level, but it was almost like a globally synchronized necessity. Otherwise, we would have had the BRICS falling out of bed. Because at that peak of just prior at the top of the COVID, when we had the dollar spike, had that continued, it would have escalated. It was also the repo and a lot of things going on there. That would have seen a lot of the emerging nations falling out of bed. And the currencies market, and for those listening, I mean, we're talking around a lot of things, but understanding the direction of the dollar and its relationship, I think if you can get that one close to being right and a bias, you have a massive advantage. Was it also to save the emergings from falling over in terms of their debt? And does that now make the emergings almost an interesting area because you've seen the rand come back to even sub 16, 15 levels? After threatening really high levels, some of the pressure on the lira has gone out, and the same goes for many other nations whose currencies have been really falling out of bed. Indian rupee, the Brazilian real, these are big populations and big nations of people. I'm just interested in your emergings market comment with the FX angle first before we drill down into maybe anything else like equities.
Yeah, so one thing I do is I look at the emerging markets. What are their dollar-denominated debts as a percentage of GDP, and what are their FX reserves as a percentage of GDP? And the reason both are important is because some of them have substantial dollar debts, but then they also have substantial, dollar assets to defend their currency when needed. Whereas there are other ones like Turkey and Argentina, they were quite vulnerable because they had the dollar debts, but they didn't really have a ton of FX reserves. And so those are the ones where we saw currency crises. Whereas if you look at a country like China, they have a lot of absolute dollar debt, right? So the total amount of dollar debt is pretty high, but as a percentage of GDP, it is pretty manageable. And then also their large FX reserves as a percentage of GDP also support that. And so that's why we haven't really seen a currency crisis in a place like China or in much of Asia in general, because a lot of them have high FX reserves. But we have seen weakness in Latin America more. We've seen weakness in Turkey, and so. The US's actions were, not altruistically to bail out emerging markets. It was mainly to bail out the US Treasury market. And because when that dollar spiked, it breaks a lot of things. It broke emerging markets. It broke, the whole euro dollar system. But then as a consequence, it broke the US Treasury market. And the reason for that is because foreigners, if they, they have all this dollar denominated debt coming through. And that was at a time when oil was like falling out of bed, and so the circulation of dollar trade around the world was weakening, and we have all of this dollar denominated debt out in the world, and that still has to be serviced. So that represents demand for dollars. And I know you're gonna have Brent. I don't know if you already had him or you're going to have
No,
him.
it's
That
still to
that's
follow,
something
yeah.
he. Yeah. So there's a lot of, and that's a point he's totally right on, that there's a lot of dollar-based debt in the world, and all of that represents demand for the dollars. And so we saw in March this scramble for dollars. Everybody had to have dollars. And so what some of those countries did is they have something like 13 trillion in dollar-denominated debts out in the world, offshore the United States. But they also have something like 42 trillion in U.S. assets. That includes treasuries. That includes corporate bonds. That includes U.S. real estate. That includes U.S. stocks. And there's not always a high match. So, for example, a place like Turkey does not have a lot of dollar assets, but a place like Saudi Arabia does. And so what we saw is some of those, the nations that did have treasury reserves, they started selling treasuries to get dollars. And so when you had the foreign sector being net sellers of treasuries, then of course you had risk parity funds that are highly levered. They had to start selling treasuries. And so we had, the treasury market became illiquid in March. And the Federal Reserve freaked out. If you look through their meeting minutes, they said the treasury market ceased to function, and they said they turned to extraordinarily rapid purchases of treasuries to fix that. And so they bought $1 trillion worth of treasuries in 3 weeks, and to basically create dollars, smooth out the treasury market. And then they even though they tapered that extraordinarily rapid purchase, they're still buying at $120 billion of QE per month, and something like 80 or 90 billion of that is treasuries. And so we are seeing basically this less tightening. And so the main concern is to basically defend the treasury market, because they can let certain things fail, but they'll never let the treasury market fail. And so whenever that kind of has too many sellers, not enough buyers, you'll see the Federal Reserve come in and create new bank reserves and buy treasuries as needed.
Right. So in that essence, in your opinion, that was the pressure valve that saw them provide that extra dollar liquidity.
Yeah, it's all fun and games till the treasury market breaks, right? Because it's also, if you look back at it's a little different, but it's similar. If you look back at the 2018 Powell pivot, so he was saying quantitative tightening is on autopilot, And you know, he was saying that we're going to keep hiking rates. And then in the fourth quarter of 2018, we had a pretty sharp sell-off in U.S. assets, right? So the S&P 500 had a 20% decline. We saw a disproportionate sell-off in U.S. tech equity. So if you look at Apple, it had something like a 30 or 40% decline that quarter. It was kind of crazy, and that's unthinkable today. But that was, you know, that was 2 years ago, and you know, and that basically forced Powell to then say, okay, we're actually, you know, we're going to always evaluate financial conditions. Nothing's on autopilot. You know, forgive us. So a lot of people looked at the stock market and thought that, you know, Powell must be trying to defend the stock market, which is, you know, in part true. But was a more concerning thing is that underneath the surface, there were no high yield bonds issued for like 6 weeks during that period. The whole credit market just froze.
Wow.
And so that's actually the more fundamental thing that, and Powell has a background in that. He was aware of that. And so that's the more underlying problematic thing whenever basically the dollar situation gets too tight. You know, that it's those things under the surface, like, you know, the credit market, or even more acutely, the treasury market. When those things break, that's when the Fed just, you know, they break the glass and they come in with whatever tool they need. Whereas the stock market, you know, they can let that squirm a little bit because that's a little bit less critical.
Yes, so many people forget because we are a culture of equity that in fact it's the debt markets are far larger and the currency markets on top of that even larger still. And that's the real plumbing of the economic system, not your favorite stock at all. And that was a great reminder there. Thank you for that. So we've had a good look at currencies, and at the moment it seems we're probably going to bias to a little bit of continuation. You're not concerned a little bit? I suppose we've spoken about it's a crowded trade. You mentioned you'd already touched on that. It's record shorts, I have heard, on the dollars, but the point we're kind of taking as a result of that is it can become more record before it potentially eventually turns, and there's quite a bit of potential downside. And if we were to have any further problems in the US debt markets, we could even see an acceleration potentially. Has that scenario been considered by you?
And you know, to get on to your point about whether I'm concerned, it's mostly for me about defining time frames. And so, you know, I've been asked in a couple of things what I think about the dollar, and my answer has been, you know, I have no clue over the next 3 to 6 months what's going to happen with the dollar. Like, so I'll leave that to people that are following the technicals, people that are, you know, things like that. Think, you know, whether or not we get stimulus. There's these kind of like a couple variables that will influence what happens over the next 3 to 6 months. Also, the virus, if we get, you know, more and more shutdowns in Europe, the United States, or things like that, and that can prevent, you know, dollars from circulating around the world. And so you can get a pretty quick backup in the dollar and relieve some of that, you know, crowded trade situation pretty readily. But then I'd be on the other, you know, if that were to happen, I would be then, you know, expecting another round of dollar weakness from there. And so it's not that I'd think that, you know, it's crowded and has to keep getting more crowded or extending. It's more just like, you know, over the next 3 to 5 years, I think that this will extend pretty hard, but then it will have counter rallies within that context. And I wouldn't be surprised, because we are so crowded at this point, to see one of those counter rallies happen in the next 3 months or so. I wouldn't be, if in fact, I would consider that, you know, a higher than 50% chance. Just because, you know, when something does get stretched, it has a tendency to, you know, the probability that it's going to push back, you know, heightens.
Absolutely. You're talking technically. I think you're probably on the trend remaining the same, but there's a bit more volatility and pushback maybe coming along the way on the way down. So because it was pretty much a very almost straight line. If you look at the weekly chart, if you're not overly on the minutiae time frames. Which brings in gold. I'm checking the comments as well, Lynn. So if you see me peeping out of my right eye, you have my full attention. But just we're live streaming, and one of the folks, Greg Closet, says precious metals and your take on that. Well, there's precious metals. I also want to pay you credit for a uranium call that you made not so long ago on your newsletter as well. That's had us looking at the energy markets. But let's stay with a question from the questioner. Gold and silver. I think it ties in a little bit now with the dollar because you can't really discuss them independently of each other. But even if we considered, say, the gold against the pound or the euro as a separate chart, which I can also bring out, how you stand on the precious metals?
So their strongest correlation, especially for gold, the strongest correlation is with real rates. And so if we look at real rates defined as, in this case, the 10-year treasury minus the 10-year inflation break even. So that that bottomed in late August, right around that same time that the Nasdaq had a big blow off top and gold had a big blow off top. And so real rates got down to negative 1.08%. And that was, that's a pretty big low. And then we started to get 10-year yields rising. So inflation expectations stayed relatively flat, while nominal yields began rising. And so that negative yield pushed back up from being at negative 1.08% to, if I recall, 0.77% negative. And so it's still negative, it's just less negative than it was. But then, in November, that started, rolling over again. And so now we're back down to negative 1%. And so, and we've seen some life out of gold, in the past couple of weeks, after it came off of a bottom. And so my general, expectation is that in the year ahead, I think gold is likely to do well. There are a couple, catalysts that could prevent that. One is that, that revival of gold would be based on the premise that real rates are going to go negative again. They're going to go, deeper than negative 1.08%. Now, if we were to get, for example, the 10-year keeps going up, or if we get, just kind of a sharp decline in inflation expectations, then we could see more weakness out of gold. The other thing is that, there's some concern this year that Bitcoin's taking some of gold's thunder. And I, so far, I think that concern's been overblown because, a lot of people are looking at the weakness in gold and assuming it has to be because of Bitcoin, whereas gold has mainly just been doing what it always does, which is, follow real interest rates. And so it's been rather tightly correlated to real interest rates, and therefore it's not really doing anything unusual. But yeah, we do have a couple kind of select instances of hedge funds saying they sold their gold to buy Bitcoin or things like that. I don't expect that to really spread too much, but if it were to, that could present some weakness in gold. But overall, I like a pretty broad mix here. So I like gold, I like silver, I like uranium, I like platinum, copper. I've been bullish on copper. That's again, it's a little bit stretched here. But long term, I like copper, then I also like Bitcoin. And so rather than bet too heavily on any one of them, I like all of them with a multi-year view.
Yeah, that's great. You're talking about a stable of horses and not just overweighting on the fastest horse, which I think is very smart and pertinent. A bit of old world money, a bit of new world money. That makes total sense to me. So just going back to the metals, because this will affect silver, it'll affect platinum, which has lagged horribly because palladium's been eating its dinner on the catalytic converters front. It seems that the negative real rates. What if I just throw in the fact that I don't trust the inflation rates? I'm like a John Williams guy, shadow stats, and actually we're probably way more negative than is being admitted to. And even if they go positive, it's a fake positive. We should be probably at about 10%. In fact, we're having inflation. It's an asset price inflation. There's a lot of retail skullduggery in terms of what they call, I forget the phrase people use, but size adjustments. They call it micro reducements in packaging sizes with minor price increases rather than a substantial price increase for a like-for-like product. Toilet rolls not unwinding to the same length. Various basket of goods, let's call it, they shapeshift a tiny bit. And you're of the view that they're, regardless of the statistics, we're deeper in the negative real interest rates because that's what's required with the amount of debt that we've created. Doesn't it, even in spite of possible variances and upticks in rates, still keep the heater and the bull bias on precious metals generally across the board?
I think so, and that's why I keep holding. And so, based on where we are in terms of the long-term debt cycle, I do think that real interest rates are likely to be negative for quite a long time. Basically, meaning that bonds and cash will have to lose value, in order to for debt markets not to explode. And so, that's a similar situation that we saw in the 1940s. And so, I'm expecting kind of a similar outcome here. And as it pertains to the real inflation rate rather than just the headline rate, there are a couple of things. One is that if you look at gold itself, gold tends to follow the real the reported rate of you know in, of CPI, and so it's over the very long term, gold keeps up with broad money supply, and so that actually is that's the much higher rate, right? So money supply is growing at a much quicker rate than official CPI, and so in that sense, gold benefits from asset price inflation that is higher than consumer price inflation. But then if you look at, say, a 5-year chart of real interest rates and gold price, gold is tightly correlated to those reported official, real rates. And so that's what dictates its movements in any kind of given, multi-year period. And so my base case is that, broad money supply is going to keep growing at, 10% a year or more. According to my model, gold is pretty fairly valued against that. And so I would expect to see continued gold price appreciation. And if you do get deeper negative rates as officially reported, then gold could, kind of spike. And there are a couple of catalysts for that. One is, we'll see if the Fed tries to move to control the long end of the yield curve. So far, they've been, they're taking a lot of excess supply off the market by buying a lot of those bonds, but they're not formally blocking the long end of the curve from rising. And so if in the couple of years ahead, if you do get kind of a spike in inflation, even officially reported inflation, then I do think you could get, the Fed's probably not going to let bond yields get very high. And so you could see, a negative spike in real yields, and you could see a positive spike in gold and other commodities. And, as far as, official inflation, like you point out, I like to separate, I view it three types of inflation, right? So there's monetary inflation, which is just, increases in the broad money supply, especially on a per capita basis. And then there's asset price inflation, which is when a lot of that money just flows into financial assets like, stocks and gold and bonds and art and wine and Bitcoin. And then there's consumer price inflation, which is a much harder basket to measure because, we have, for example, healthcare is going up very high. We have childcare is going up very high. Services. We have shrinkflation, like you talked about, like that, that sneaky form of inflation. But then it's been offset to some extent by a couple factors. One is, manufacturing inflation remains pretty low. So, by technology and offshoring, electronics, for example, keep getting cheaper. Software keeps eating the world. And then also, if you look at a lot of commodity prices outside of the precious metals, a lot of them are roughly where they were 15 years ago. And because we've had this period of commodity oversupply, and so until basically oil is tight and gas is tight, as long as commodities remain pretty cheap, it's hard to get that really, really broad, consumer price inflation outside of the services sector. And so if in the years ahead, due to all of this CapEx cuts in the oil fields that we've had this year, and if you see copper shortages, you see energy shortages, you see uranium shortages, whatever the case may be, you can get that can potentially trickle into a much higher kind of broad CPI basket,
I think
especially when combined with very high kind of a broad money supply increases.
Yes, I was just wondering if that isn't exactly the case that's possibly threatening on a number of fronts. I mean, uranium supply, they clear in an overhang. They're undersupplying, but there's an overhang. Many people are always trying to quantify silver, and we're expecting the use to spike with solar and all these green initiatives that seem very politically pertinent and, very much this color for our times. And and it just the money proliferation, politically, because economics is politics as well, power, money, and social choices. This pivot, well, it seems the Democrats are getting in, unless there's some final twists that some people might think are possible still. But to me, it seems very much like they're getting in. There's an embracement. I mean, is modern monetary theory now accepted policy? Because that would add to the other very important variable that you mentioned, that liquidity, the on-ramp for UBI, because we're going into another crushing of the SME cycle with the multiple lockdowns and all of that. Aren't we pretty strong in that case that we're going to be high liquidity, money for all, proliferation, which probably points again to further dollar weakness to highlight your, I think, probably quite accurate view that we probably got lower to go before we bottom. And as a result, this is going to be pretty supportive fundamental environment for Bitcoin, gold, silver across the board.
I think so. I think when we look out over the next several years, I do think we're going to continue to see very large deficits that are being, you know, largely monetized by central banks in the United States and elsewhere in the world. And you know, to the extent that MMT is embraced, it really depends on what market you look at. And so in the United States, it's a mixed bag. So a lot of politicians are moving in that direction. Other politicians are, you know, still you know, kind of resistant to that direction. In Europe, of course, because you know, all of those countries gave up their monetary sovereignty, and so they have to agree together on certain fiscal packages. You know, that's a much slower moving process as well. And so you have a lot of those countries that are not on the MMT you know, train. Japan is, you know, they're, because they're not very polarized, they're able to do pretty big things pretty fast. So they're, you know, they're kind of like the US, where they're, you know, they're potentially on the a little bit on the MMT side here. And so I think it really depends on what markets you look at. And I think over the overall picture here, you know, we are seeing a sharp increase in broad money supply. I do think that's going to continue. And then, yeah, the big question is what's going to happen with commodity scarcity. And, you know, a lot of people think of the United States as still being the center of commodities. But really, at this point, it's you know, Asia and China in particular. China is like the biggest consumer of copper. Yeah. You know, they're the biggest energy importer. And so, you know, a lot of eyes have to be on China to see what their policy is going to be in terms of, you know, how it could affect iron, could affect copper, could affect oil. And so, but overall, I think globally, we're probably looking at a period of, you know, continued money supply increases and then potentially some degree of commodity shortage as we look out into maybe late 2021, 2022, 2023. Now, in the near term, you know, with rising virus, you know, hospitalizations and economic shutdowns, and just, you know, just this general period of uncertainty, you know, I don't really have a strong view over the next 3 to 6 months what's going to happen. I mean, this could be a pretty rough winter. We're still going through a solvency cycle, right? So earlier this year, you know, there was a lot of liquidity issues, but we're still seeing solvency problems where a lot of companies have debts, a lot of them don't have cash flows yet. And so I, you know, I still think we have a lot more kind of some deflationary shocks to go through over the next several months. And so I'm not really kind of pushing the inflation theme too hard in this kind of shorter period. But I do think the longer you look out, the more the odds favor that more inflationary scenario.
I was going to say in my next point, and I think you almost touched really, almost clarified on that. Surely most of the risks are to the downside in this tail end of economic cycle. If there's an asymmetry for bear or negative shocks than optimistic ones, almost. And as a result, that must keep a sort of deflationary boogeyman ever present in the closet waiting to stumble out to create another, well, we've had our pandemic event, but other repo type rates, more directly financial rather than second derivative financial. So are most of the shocks bearish ones? Can we think of any ones that would be upside?
So I think upside has a couple different connotations, because upside could be, you know, it's often thought in finance that, you know, deflation's bad and inflation's good. And so you get that deflationary insolvency shock, it's quote bad. And if you get the, you know, the inflationary outcome, it's good, because that's what policymakers are literally aiming for. Whereas really, you know, I think that there are shocks to both the upside and the downside, because if you do get that deflationary shock in such a highly levered world, then yeah, then you do get like a March-like scenario where we're at risk assets sell off, the dollar goes up, you get that, you know, that boogeyman comes out of the closet again. And I do think, you know, it's a good thing that people are still considering that, because otherwise, you know, this trade would be done already, right? If every single person gets on one side of the boat, that's when the trade's done. Yeah. And so as long as there still is that you know, fear, uncertainty, and doubt, right? There's good arguments for deflation. There's good arguments for inflation. And so as long as that debate is raging, you know, there's not too many people on one side of the trade, at least in the long term sense. Like two people can be piled in kind of a near term, you get a correction. But you know, if you look at where big money's invested, you know, big money is still in, you know, the broad S&P 500. It's not in commodities. It's not in the rest of the world. It's still piled into, you know, large cap U.S. stocks. And so, you know, kind of the more tactical position is short dollar and, you know, all that. Whereas big money still hasn't, those oceans haven't really rotated yet. And so I do think that there are risks of, insolvency spikes, dollar spikes, deflationary spikes. And so all of those are things I'm concerned about. And that's why, I express a lot of this through equities, and I tend to prefer some of the higher quality equities. So for example, if I'm going to invest in an energy company, I'd rather buy one with a strong balance sheet and, low production costs that can get through a rough period, rather than buy the absolute most levered, piece of junk out there that, it can have higher percent gains, but they can get wrecked if the thesis takes longer to play out. So I like to, I always err to the side of solvency and conservatism, even when I'm kind of investing along my
Smart.
theme. And so that's how I'm viewing it, basically, is, maintaining kind of portfolio construction, maintaining an emphasis on quality, so that you can handle those kind of pushbacks against the overall thesis, because those deflationary forces, those dollar debts, those insolvency risks, those are all real. They're not to be dismissed. And especially when things get overbought, that's when you have to be, more cautious.
Crazy scenario. The World Economic Forum is right. We have a grid down period and hacking of banks, and they blame it on Russia, North Korea. That would be a overall a deflationary frightening event, I'm assuming, in our worldview books. Where's the defensive plays in that environment?
Sorry, can you repeat that?
Yeah,
I
sure.
think I missed
So
part of it.
Klaus Schwab of the World Economic Forum is elevating his profile quite extensively now, along with the pandemic outcomes and various other things. And he's recently done another almost warning, ominous prediction, having previously predicted the scope for the pandemic prior to it happening. And his latest scenario of shock and awe would be a threat that he identifies is cross-national hacking. So he would say an attack. So he's kind of calling a black hat sort of tech-based hacking on financial services. There's been an escalation of chatter, I'm observing, through The Economist and a variety of other FBI tweet feeds, of various other that people have been getting into the Treasury. Specifically, they mentioned the Treasury, and you're a master of understanding how we loan money into existence. So there's bad actors type events, which is based on nation states. Let's just leave it at that as a possible scenario that sees some sort of disarray being sown into the economic system. And my assumption is that's invariably going to be a deflationary event that will be deflating for stocks and many other things. Were that to come to play, how, just as a scenario, that could be a sort of follow-up COVID type event. How would folk, if they felt this was a plausible event, how do you position for that? I'm assuming tangibility, obviously, because we're talking about electricity. In that scenario, they also spoke of an electricity grid down. In other words, disabling a large part of a nation state. We're very digitized now, so this is a switching off of most things. Like a stream like this would obviously not be possible, and many other things, and the internet down, etc. I'm just curious. It's quite a little bit, forgive the question, a little bit apocalyptic, but nonetheless, I'm just considering it.
Yeah, if you do get a tail risk like that, I think it would be a lot like March. And of course, it depends on how long it persists, right? So, if it happens for days or weeks, that's different than if it somehow happens for months. And so, earlier this month, we saw, the U.S. Treasury was reported to be hacked into. We had a really extensive cyber attack on U.S. systems,
That's
supposedly
it.
by the Russians. And I think that's still being confirmed. But I think the suspicion is that it's the Russians. It's a very sophisticated attack. And so, that was one of those hacks where, they got a lot of emails, and they've been doing it for months, so they collected a ton of information. But of course, they didn't shut down any sort of key infrastructure. There are risks around utilities being attacked, or other kind of major defense systems being attacked, things like that. And if you were to get, kind of a cyber attack driven power outage or internet outage, that is of course catastrophic in our very digital focused age. And that's one of those cases where probably precious metals would be one of the better investments to hold in that case,
I
right? So
was thinking that.
even if
Sorry, carry on.
Yeah,
No, okay.
even if people are bullish on Bitcoin, and I am, and if you're bullish on other things like that, that's where one of those things where physical precious metals would be a nice hedge. And so I think that's one of those scenarios that's hard to plan for, right? Tail risks are inherently challenging to plan for because if you base your portfolio on that happening, and at any given year, it's a low probability of like a massive, cyber attack that brings down utilities and things like that. So it's one of those things where you want to maybe have a hedge for it, but not plan around it. And of course, you want to have whatever safeguards you need in your own home. You want to have access to resources, food, something off the grid. People have their own kind of ways of preparation. But basically, society is very kind of fragile. The way we structured things over the past several decades, supply chains are fragile, computer networks are fragile. Just this how we manage our resources are fragile. And really, the pandemic showed that, right? So the pandemic showed how fragile our supply chains are, how kind of vulnerable our economy is that, we have this pandemic and we do shutdowns and we have, hundreds of thousands of restaurants go out of business while big companies just come in and take their market share. And we have protests because people are, just are cooped up and they're facing all sorts of financial issues and then there's social issues. And so it kind of showed that it's a very kind of, with so much debt in the system and so much interconnectivity, it's inherently a very fragile system that's vulnerable to any sort of shocks, either ones that you think are, that you're identified ahead of time or ones that you don't identify at all.
It's a difficult one to answer because it's so out there. But it's just, I think there seems to the part of the pandemic thinking is that more and more people have opened their mind to these tail risks, as you correctly suggested. And it seems we might not be over them, and there might be forecasting of other end of cycle. You're a fan of the fourth turning, I think. Have I said the name right of the book? And it just seems like there's quite a lot of turmoil potentially to be navigated. And what is the defense? And I don't think you can actively defend for that because unless you have information that's happening, but you can have a component of it in a portfolio, which will hopefully outperform. Because otherwise, if you set up for that event and you go 10 years without anything happening, you've lost immense alpha in terms of your performance. For being a pessimist. Okay, I'm gonna check the questions and just keep in touch. So guys are talking about Russia. So I think I heard somebody even refer. We had George on, and he was referring to Russia representing value in a sense on both debt and other things. Is it a market that you talk about or consider much? And I think you did say, apologies, energy's quite dominant, obviously. I think you said you saw that. And the ruble is strengthened against the dollar a little because everybody has. And of course, they don't have the debt that they used to. Where's the emerging players? And you also mentioned Malaysia, well, you didn't say Malaysia specifically, but Southeast Asia. If I just flick through to an interesting Seeking Alpha article, I'm reminded of Harry Dent's favorite subject, which is demographics, which in this particular article, they're referring to it as the iceberg of investment management. It's 90% underwater and moves quite slowly. The cycle is generational as well, so it's sort of a very slow steamroller, but you can't fight it. So one cannot trade the process, but ultimately it's the primary determinant of the economy. If people are thinking and they're fluid, should we not all be in on the if we're just playing the demographics, which as they've already said is quite slow and steamrolls slowly, should we not be in Malaysia where the average age is 27 and it's a young growing economy, growth following the population numbers because we are on the wrong side of the boomers now, and we have bad pension issues in the States and in Europe. What's your take on the demographic challenge? Where's the great growth going to come?
So I am bullish on Malaysia. In addition to good demographics and a pretty good tech culture, they also have pretty high foreign exchange reserves as a percentage of GDP. And that's because if you look back in the late 90s dollar spike, Malaysia was caught up in the Asian financial crisis, right? So you had crisis in Thailand, you had crisis in Malaysia, you had crisis in Russia, and South Korea, and that spread throughout the region, and a lot of those countries are the ones that are really prepared this time. And so, they learned from the issues of late 90s, early 2000s. And so, Malaysia built up big foreign exchange reserves. Thailand built up big foreign exchange reserves. South Korea did, and Russia did. And so they all went into this period with much stronger fundamentals. And so some of the currencies were sold off temporarily. Some of them are still like ruble's still pretty cheap, but the fundamentals. And so Russia, if we start kind of one at a time, Russia has one of the lowest debt levels in the world, whether you look at government debt, household debt, corporate debt. It's all, it's a very under-levered society. They have very high foreign exchange reserves. They went into this crisis with a government surplus, a trade surplus, and low debts. And so they were pretty well prepared. Now, of course, they were slammed by the fact that they're reliant on energy prices being pretty solid, and energy was killed this year. And so we saw a weakening ruble. We saw, all of that. But I'm favorable on Russia. Now, they have poor demographics. However, their equities are so extremely cheap, and pretty strong, and reasonably well managed, that I'm pretty bullish on Russia. And so, for example, if you look at their oil company Lukoil, for
Yeah.
example, that's cheaper than most other energy majors. They have longer oil reserves than most other energy majors. They
Yeah.
have less debt than most other energy majors. And so, basically, for dollar, you're getting a much stronger company. And they actually had some of the best returns on invested capital and the best total returns over the past 10 and 20 years.
Yeah.
And because Lukoil has a very Western style of management, the optimized shareholder returns, they were influenced by Mark Mobius and others. And so, they historically have a very strong set of management. And so, basically, you get a lot more bang for your buck with them compared to, say, like ExxonMobil, as an example. And they have a low production cost. So that's an example of value. And it's kind of separate from whatever Russian demographics are going to do. Similarly, if you look at, Russia's leading bank, Sberbank, they have, some of the highest returns on an equity among global banks. They have a wide economic moat, dominant market share. They're one of the most tech-savvy banks, right? So they're deep into digital adoption, and they've tested blockchain technologies. So they are, and they're historic. They're way cheaper than other banks around the world, and because no one's really interested in Russian stocks. And
Give us
so
that name
I'm
again, Lennon.
pretty.
I'll pull it up for you. Sorry, I missed it.
That'd be Sberbank, SBER, Sberbank. And so there's an ADR, and then of course it also trades on Moscow Stock Exchange. And so that has historically been, it's been a weak performer like most banks over the past, 5 to 10 years. But they, are extraordinarily cheap, and they generally are pretty profitable. And I think overall Russian equities are pretty attractive.
Yeah, it sounds like an emerging market you're interested in. I'm just sitting wondering with our trading community whether people just care enough to go into the great unknown and do that. And I think if you're a global investor, you absolutely should. But I'm wondering, is there particular asset classes right now regularly available? Not for the global macro individual equity in foreign nations investor, which is probably your forte, but for more for our retail trader and investor that you feel is your hottest position right now. I mean, let's touch on cryptos. You are a Bitcoin bull, and you made a great document, which I've already referred to, that dealt with many of the issues. We dealt with could the government cancel Bitcoin, for example, and we considered all the potential risks and I think we came to the conclusion anything's possible, but it's not particularly likely. How do you feel given the crypto's recent moves? Because obviously, what applied at 10 or 12,000 now sees the better part of 24,000. If I just bring our crypto chart up, and on the big time frame, it's virtually straight up. And in fact, I can even drop that to a dual weekly, a fortnightly chart, and it's super strong.
Yeah, I'm still bullish on Bitcoin, and so I originally pivoted on Bitcoin. I entered it in April at 6,900, and then I kept reiterating that with public articles. So I, my first article was it was a little over 9,000. Then I had a second article when it was a little bit over 15,000, and so I've been kind of reiterating my bullish Bitcoin view through 2021. I expected to do reasonably well. And there's a couple of factors for that. One is, it's very accessible. So people ranging from the United States to Russia to Nigeria to Australia, anywhere in the world almost, people can access it. And so it's a way for investors to basically have, I've seen it described as like an offshore bank account for everyone, right? Everyone can kind of put their money into this thing that is outside of the jurisdiction of any one government. And of course, some governments try to ban it, try to regulate it, and they can do that. But then other countries remain open to it, and it's a decentralized encrypted network, and so it can't be directly stopped easily. And so it's and if you look at a lot of people get thrown off by the fact that if they look at the linear chart, it looks silly, right? Because it goes up in 2017, turns parabolic, and then it has a big crash, and it looks like a bubble. But if you zoom out to the beginning, and if you look at the logarithmic chart, and then if you take into account the fact that if you look at how Bitcoin operates, every 4 years or so, the number of new Bitcoins generated every 10 minutes gets cut in half, and that's it's called a halving. And generally speaking, if you look at the logarithmic chart and then you put the halving points on that chart, you get a very, very clear pattern where every 4 years or so, Bitcoin goes through the cycle where it kind of finds a price equilibrium. Then there's a supply shock as the supply gets cut in half. Demand remains pretty persistent, so then you get kind of a big increase in price. Then you get, of course, momentum traders and FOMO, and everybody piles into it. You get a blow off top, then you get a crash, you get a consolidation again. Then then the 4 years later, there's another supply halving, and it all starts again. And we've been through like three of those cycles. And so where we are in the halving cycle is historically a very bullish phase for Bitcoin. And it's probably, my base case would be that it's going to extend, well into 2021. And we'll see from there. And I keep evaluating it. So, for example, back in my November 22nd report, I warned that okay, Bitcoin's parabolic. I'm still very bullish, but I wouldn't be surprised to see a correction or consolidation here because it was coming up to all-time highs, right? So it was getting and that's what it did. So it had that correction on Thanksgiving, American Thanksgiving, and then it went sideways for a couple weeks, kind of just staying right under the previous all-time highs. It touched it and then back down. And then, so my base case then was okay, until it breaks over 20,000, it's vulnerable to ongoing corrections. But once it breaks through 20,000, it's somewhat de-risked, right? Because then it clears over that resistance. And then you just out of nowhere, on the day of the Fed FOMC meeting, we got Bitcoin just plowed through 20,000 and it touched 2,400. It's been trading in the, 23. It touched 24,000. It's been trading in the 23,000 range, and so again, if you look at the weekly chart, it's overbought on the weekly chart as it often was during the 2017 bull run. Some of those overbought periods were associated with pretty sharp corrections, and so I wouldn't be shocked to see wake up one day and see Bitcoin in a pretty deep correction, but that's still within the context of being bullish, with another 12-month view at least.
It's a high volatility trajectory, which goes with associated strong corrections up to 30%, even more. Those blue boxes are those kind of that first year of the halvenings, the 2013 post the 12, the 17 post the 16, and we're really just getting started at the 20, the back end of the 20. I agree with you, and we're very strong bullish here, but we also expect. We're expecting a bit of a reaction if we run 25/7. That's come purely technical. And like you just said, quite intuitively, we also felt that there'd be a small stutter at the previous technical high, which is also a killer round number as well. Probably next after 10,000 is the 20,000 mark. So yeah, it's going great. And we're looking really, really forward to that. Any predictions generally? Any outside outside of the box, what's your? I mean, Saxo, for example, does these out of world crazy calls where it's not about being right, just stretch your brain, be absurd if you have to. If Lynn Alden, which you aren't typically, you're very rational, but if you were to have an out there possibility that might be underpriced coming up in the new year, I like to try and make bold predictions. We were actually very big on the oil short, gold long, the oil to single digits, and we were wrong. We were too timid. It actually went negative. But do you have something like that that fundamentally you just think, I just wonder if these two events occurred, that could trigger that, and not many people are talking about it, and maybe it's not being appreciated. What would you put out there?
So a couple of things. One is just, continuing the previous thing. I think Bitcoin could potentially reach pretty silly numbers in 2021, and it's not guaranteed. But if it continues on anything like the previous halving cycles, I wouldn't be surprised to see it double and more from here. And so, I do think that it could be pretty explosive in 2021. Within the context of halving corrections being quite volatile. And so, there are certain things that could potentially derail that bull market. But I think left to its own devices, there's quite a lot of bullishness to be had there. The other key catalyst I'm looking for, and I don't know if this is going to happen in 2021 or not, but just something I think is kind of an end game scenario, is that if you look back in the 1940s, at the previous end of the long-term debt cycle, end of the fourth turning, you had World War II, and so you had massive government deficits, massive debt, and of course the central bank had to buy a lot of those debts. So you had the Fed buying a lot of treasuries, you had the U.S. banking system buying a lot of those treasuries, and what the Fed did was they did yield curve control. So they said, okay, we're going to hold the long end of the yield curve at 2.5%, we're going to hold T-bills at 0.38%, and we're going to create dollars and buy treasuries as needed to maintain that peg. And so, given an unlimited printing press and a stated thing where you're going to hold yields at a certain rate, you can do it. But then, of course, the release valve is the currency, because if yields are not keeping up with inflation, anyone holding cash or treasuries gets killed in real terms. And so, that's what happened in the 1940s, where you had three big inflation spikes. Two of them were double-digit inflation spikes, and one of them was high single digits. And if you look at the 10-year treasury yield, it was just perfectly flat at 2.5%, like magic, because they were doing formal yield curve control. And so, in 2019, some Fed officials began discussing the prospect for yield curve control. And of course, in early 2020, after the treasury market, had some volatility, the FOMC minutes, again, Fed officials were talking about yield curve control. They decided they didn't need it yet, and that they'd revisit it in the future. And so, if you were to get an inflation spike, whether it's late 2021, whether it's 2022, some point in the next several years, if you were to get an inflation trend, in the 1970s they were able to raise rates because there were very low debt levels. But in the 1940s they did not raise rates; they held rates low and they did yield curve control because sovereign debt was so high and the fiscal deficits were so high. And so I do think that if you were to get that inflation spike, the Fed would come in and do yield curve control, and that's where things get interesting, because then if they say, okay, we're not going to let the 10-year go over 2%, if inflation goes to, let's call it 5%, then you have -3% real yields, based on say official CPI, and then you can get a blow off in gold, silver, commodities, Bitcoin, whatever the case may be. And then, of course, some of those markets are very, levered in terms of paper, right? So if you get a massive gold spike, if a lot of the bond market wants to pour into gold, you could potentially, disrupt the futures market, and kind of call a bluff on that big paper market. And so that's where some of the kind of the upside catalyst could be as far as the precious metals market's concerned. And so, I think that, and of course, if you look at uranium, people are that have been following the uranium space. Again, I don't really know if it's a 2021 story, but if you look at it over the next 5 years, there are some pretty significant supply-demand imbalances that are projected. And so, uranium is one of those things that it could double or triple, and then of course, some of the uranium stocks that are levered to that outcome could go up pretty dramatically. And so, I think there are some of those asymmetric things out there, ranging from Bitcoin to uranium to, some sort of yield curve control kind of driving at precious metals. I think there are a couple of those kind of stepwise increases where, you might wake up one weekend and there's been some announcement and everything's lit up. And so it's one of those things that could be challenging to trade.
Well, I like that. Those are great scenarios. You almost have me wishing for some of them because I like the uranium call. It falls into the commodities. I think it's clean power with nuclear. We did this whole reversing out of nuclear with Fukushima, and I think there's a flow back in now. because we aren't going to fill the gap as fast as we want, no matter what, we will for the green environment. In fact, your colleague and friend George was referring to coal. He's still in the old school as well, and he sees that as part of the gap for energy requirements as well. I like the uranium. I love the idea of Bitcoin. I do think it's probably your best trade, but it's high volatility and you're going to have to watch it. So you should definitely have a bit of that. But the best thing is not to watch the chart too much and lock it up. Very good. Lynn, thank you so much. We've taken a lot of your time. We love having you on. Such great insights. I like that summary of the big outsiders that could come romping home, the Fed's control of the yield curve. Do you think that, as a parting shot, having done all these bad things in the 40s and realized that it kind of didn't work, do you think we're going to go revisit errors? Do we really need, as another generation, learning the same messages? Is that history? Is it have to be that way? This is kind of more of a philosophical final question, but do we have to go? Do people not know the history? Are we going to revisit this whole MMT thing and pivoting so hard, UBI, communist proliferation? Oh, it's quite a lot bigger. It's quite a fatter tail. It's looking quite a fatter tail possibility than you would have thought 5 years ago.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where, it depends on what you're looking at. And so I hope they learn some of the lessons, especially about war and especially about other things like that. If you look at the policymakers' perspective, they often look at the 1940s as favorable because, they devalued debts. So they cleared out the debt problem. Of course, if you're a bondholder or a cash holder, you got killed. But they devalued the debts. And then, of course, the United States had a boom in the 1950s. And so from their perspective, that was not necessarily a failure. That was, a success. And of course, when you were an investor at the time, it would depend on what assets you were positioned in. If you were in cash, if you were in bonds and other paper like that, it was obviously you got hurt. But if you were in equities, if you were in real estate, if you were in silver, whatever the case may be, you did pretty well. And so,
But it
I
was
do think
also
that,
America post World War II as well, which had huge benefits when everyone else was destroyed and indebted. So.
And Europe, for example, Europe had, United States had a significant currency devaluation, but if you look elsewhere, their currency devaluations were even bigger. And so in this era, because back then the United States was a net creditor nation, and now we're a net debtor nation, we're running trade deficits. And so I do think that, going forward, I think that some of the structures of power could shift. I do think that some of the currencies could shift pretty markedly. And I don't think that policymakers are going to particularly learn from it, especially because, when they're in an environment where it's either, print or let the treasury market fail, they're always going to choose print. And so, the best we can do is position for it, and just have all the different outcomes kind of ready. So you can have hedges for different scenarios. You can have base cases, in addition to some of those explosive things I talked about. I think you asked before, like if someone's interested in international equities but doesn't want to go into individual stocks, there's always ETFs, other things like that you can get kind of a broad, say global stock exposure, or you can buy a single country ETF and get exposure to a specific market, and that can balance out your risks a little bit so that you might have commodity exposure, you might have Bitcoin exposure, you might have global equity exposure, you might have some exposure to, appropriately valued U.S. equities, whatever the case may be. To have that kind of range of outcomes prepared for.
Absolutely. Brilliant comment. Really enjoyed having you on. Thank you so much for visiting us again. I want to wish you and your family a very special Christmas. Well done on putting in such an amazing year and impressing us all and enlightening us all. Everyone, please go check out Lynn's free newsletter and her premium service for not much more than a good meal. You're getting access to one of the leading minds and researchers. Lynn Alden, thank you so much for coming on. Truly appreciate and have an amazing resting period. Christmas, whether you celebrate or not, and New Year. Thank you.
Yep, thanks for having me, and Merry Christmas to you as well.
All the best. Bye-bye.